to Founder Chats, the show where I, Josh Pickford, founder of Bearmetrics, hop on a call with my founder pals and get the stories of how they started and grew their businesses. This week, I talk with Dez Trainer, co-founder of Intercom. Dez and I talk about his path to co-founding Intercom, turning education on its head, how hiring is broken, the great rebundling of software, the role of high-quality content when it comes to company growth, and so much more. And just heads up, there's some swearing in this episode. Now let's get on with it. Hey, Dez, thanks for joining me, man.
Hey, Josh, how are you?
Doing good, doing good. So I would love to kind of kick things off with your backstory. Like, you as a kid back in Ireland. So what were you like? Like, what were you into? All that kind of stuff.
Yeah, let me think. I was always into reading and kind of half the time into writing. And until I had a friend when I was like 7 or 8, and his parents had recently purchased an Amiga 500. And at that point onwards, we just became all about computers for quite a while. Everything from like playing games to like just learning how to use absolutely every inane aspect of the Amiga workbench operating system, all the way through to like, you know, little bits and pieces of learning how to program. There was this cool plugin you could get for an Amiga where you could directly edit memory, so you could cheat and give yourself extra lives in video games and stuff. So we used to do a bit of that, and that was kind of my first exposure to any sort of real bits of like, you know, the internals of how software works. And then I think it was a relatively normal teenager. I stayed up too late playing Quake and shit. I didn't get into like proper like computer stuff, like from an you know, writing programs and stuff, until I was like, you know, maybe 18, 19 when I went to university. But aside from that, yeah, I was like, you know, a typical, I guess, European stuff, like grunge music, Nirvana, playing soccer, computer games, usual shit.
Yeah. So, I mean, like family wise, I mean, did you know, were parents or siblings or anything like that into computers too? Or, you know, I think a lot of times I hear about other founders who it's like, well, their dad or their mom was big into computers, or they had a sibling who was like huge into programming.
Yeah, so I didn't have anything like that. So I'm the youngest of 7. You know, I guess like there was only really like 2 of us who were of the right age to have been into computers. Like I was born in 81. And you have to bear in mind, like, in our, you know, computers weren't probably as popular in Ireland as they might have been in, say, Stanford or somewhere like. So it's unlikely like my older brothers or sisters would have been like, you know, they wouldn't have used a computer like when I was growing up. So the biggest influence on me from a getting into computers perspective was probably my friend Chris and his family, who were all very much passionate about computers, in particular Amigas. Which then kind of basically became my sort of start out. That was what turned my head initially anyway.
Yeah. So was there, from an entrepreneurial aspect, was there any sort of influence there, or like, did you have any sort of tendencies towards that kind of thing?
Let me think. I don't know if like Gary Vaynerchuk style stories of like, you know, selling flowers as a kid or selling baseball cards. I'm trying to think. I don't know to what degree do I really identify with the phrase, like with the true phrase of the phrase, like entrepreneur. Like, you know, like I was never passionate about like making money or employing people or any of that sort of stuff. Like, I was really like, you know, the thing that always inspired me about like software was the ability to create things that people would use, but not as much like, you know, create a business that makes this pure, beautiful profit. Like, I admire people for whom that's like their core motivation. That I have no concern with that. But like, I like seeing things I make be used and enjoyed. But I, you know, the financial or commercial aspects don't resonate with me as much. And I guess that kind of trickles. Like, I used to write stories, and I'd love to see people reading stories when I was a kid, but I never went and charged money for them, if you know what I mean.
Yep. You just enjoyed the sort of finished product and like the process of.
Yeah, I think what I enjoy most, and I still do to this day, is like seeing people use and like the things that I either make or I'm a part of making. And that you can extend that to like, you know, to this very podcast, or like to like Intercom, the product, or like a blog post I wrote or a conference talk I gave, whatever. Like, I like sharing ideas and sharing opinionated sort of products that resonate with people and that they really identify with.
Gotcha. So how did that, you know, so you go to school, I mean, university. So did you, was computer science, was that
Yeah, I studied computer science and software engineering from 1999 to 2003. And yeah, it was a tricky enough degree in that it was like 36 hours a week. It was full on. All my friends were studying arts or whatever. They had like, you know, 6, 9, 10, 12 hours. And like, not to say that their degree was just as hard as mine in different ways. But like for me, it was very full on. It's like, it's hard to get into a party lifestyle when you have like a 9 a.m. start every single day and none of your friends do. So.
So at school, you studied computer science. And then what happened like after school? You went and worked at a couple of other companies?
So what happened was in 2003, I graduated top of my class and won a few scholarships and stuff. And I kind of, you know, I think this is still kind of sadly true today. You do the thing that people who do things like you've done do, which if you graduate top of your class in university, you should go on and undertake a PhD or a study, at least for a master's. So I enrolled in a PhD program, and I was very, very interested in the idea of computer science education. That is basically trying to address the question, why is it we are so shit at teaching people how to be software engineers or programmers or coders at all? And you know, and my evidence for us being shit at it is that, frankly, the attrition, the amount of dropouts, the amount of people who are otherwise smart and occasionally quite good at actually software engineering, somehow fail to perform well in an academic environment is quite high. And so what I was trying to do was learn what's actually got the core there. So I spent 3.5 years basically working on different ways to teach and different ways to assess somebody's programming ability. And then I dropped it.
Yeah. Well, that's fascinating. I mean, like I can probably identify with that in that academics in and of itself wasn't my bag at all. Like I wasn't a great student. I felt like I could do a lot of stuff. But it was always, the traditional mold of, you know, sit there, listen to somebody lecture and then take a test, like that kind of thing never really stuck for me.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of people like that. Then I think when you take, you know, when you look at a sort of computer science curriculum, they add in a mixture of kind of basically a very diverse set of topics, some of which are quite studious, as in like learn off these 10 things and you'll be able to answer this one exam question. Some of them are quite practical. Some of them are quite impractical, as in like, you know, like write out in English how you would reverse sort a binary tree on a whiteboard or whatever. You see this kind of generally being criticized as programmer exercises today during interviews. Where my work ended up focusing on was like, why is it universities are pretty bad at detecting who is good at engineering and who is bad? Because there's so much evidence that says basically like, you know, people graduate from computer science degrees every day around the world. The vast majority of them don't end up working in the industry because somehow the university thought that they were qualified to be an engineer, but the industry didn't. And what's at the root of that mismatch? And ultimately what I came back to for me was assessment. The standard way in which universities are taught and kind of formatted into thinking, here's how we grade a piece of code, is things like, oh, if we ask the student to find the smallest variable in an array, we'll give them 2 points for identifying that it's a for loop or a while loop. We'll give them 2 points for using the sort of opening brace and closing brace. We'll give them 3 points for an if statement and 2 points, blah. And like, you can end up basically passing or even acing an exam without actually solving the problem, just by kind of pattern matching. Right. And what I found, like, and I studied this across universities in Ireland and in the UK, was that you have this, like, the template of the marking becomes the template of the learning. So students basically learn how to pass tests by following the score sheet. So they're told, oh, if it says the word array, make sure you put in a for loop. And if it says find, make sure you put in if, you know, and as a result, you get people not knowing what the hell they're doing, but they've learned off by heart what ingredients of a successful solution look like.
Yep.
Yeah. Anyway.
Well, then in general, I mean, education in general, I feel like we're kind of raising kids to be really great test takers and not actually walking away with anything. That's my wife. Like, she was top of her class and she would tell you, like, she was just really great at taking tests, but like when it came to anything practical, she just didn't stick for her. And And that's how, I mean, like, our kids now, like, we've kind of do atypical education style for them. Like, we don't want them in the public school system because of that very thing.
Yeah, I think, like, specifically, like, you know, like, the thing that people don't acknowledge enough is that how you assess something becomes how it's performed. And this is true in all aspects. It's true, like, you know, within barometrics, if you tell your marketing person that you're going to assess them based on MQLs or SQLs or dollars earned or CAC or LTV or whatever, like, it is the whole what gets measured gets done thing. And I think, as a result, how we test children specifically is, like, such a high leverage activity that never getting questioned. Because, like, we're basically, like, you know, we're telling kids, like, oh, your students are not, your children aren't doing well enough at X, Y, or Z. And the parents take that on board. They're like, hey, son, daughter, you need to do really well at X, Y, Z. And, like, lo and behold, like, what gets lost in this sort of, in this game of whispers, where, like, people are told, all right, you know, focus all your attention on the following three things, which might be, like, the, you know, reciting this poem for the exam, or it might be, you know, like, learning this opinion piece off by heart, so that if this question comes up, you can recite it. Like, I genuinely think, like, in general, assessment, and by the way, interviewing is the same thing. Like, interviewing is kind of like how we at companies perform assessment. I think we don't, like, you know, we just, people tend not to think about how high leverage it is to actually get good at assessing people in a fair way that actually taps into their true qualities, versus, you know, as I said, programmer style stuff is like, give us a red black tree, reverse sorted or whatever. And in school, I might be recite this poem by Alfred Lord Tennyson or something.
Well, and I agree, like, the assessment part, it's a tough problem, right? Like, how do you, in a fair and balanced way, sort of check the progress of someone, whether it's a student or a potential hire? Like, you want to remove the biases, but the solution we've got in place now is a little jacked up.
Yeah. And, you know, not to sort of, you know, your point is correct. It's also fair that you want to assess everyone based on their strengths, but then you also have this other principle that says you need to assess everyone fairly so you can compare one against the other, which means that you can't actually customize tests and then compare people. Right. So, like, anyway, in general, like, I know purely how hard and how difficult the problem is, but I do think that most startups I talk to, when I ask them, like, how do they interview or how do they test for, you know, how do you hire managers is a great question I ask people a lot, like, specifically because it's something I'm talking about on the Turdus here. I say, like, you know, what do you look for in a manager and how do you detect that? And, like, the answer is so off the cuff. I read this point in a blog post once and it was kind of interesting, so I always ask that. And, like, part of me is kind of, shocked, because I'm like, this is probably one of the most high leverage things that you do, is, like, detect and identify the talented people who are going to manage your star players. And you're interviewing them based off a good blog post you once read. You know, have you considered the idea that maybe you're not doing a great job of this?
Right. Oh, man. All right. We can talk about education the entire time. Let's keep moving. So graduated PhD program, which you dropped out of, correct?
Yeah.
And then you went to do some usability work.
Yeah, that's right. So, like, what I actually did was, the reason I dropped out was because I started writing this blog, which was at devstrainer.com, imaginatively enough. And I used to just write about usability and just kind of, I general, like, usability was the buzzword for what we'd now call, like, product design or whatever today. Right. But in 2006, it was like the web 2.0 version of this was usability. So I used to write about, like, basically, here's how to shit software and here's how it should be redesigned to be better. That was kind of the general theme of what I'd write about. And I think after maybe a year of doing that, I got approached by a usability design consultancy in Ireland saying, hey, you should come work for us. Here's an exercise if you're interested. So I did the exercise. They really liked it. And they offered me a job. And kind of without really knowing what I was doing, I knew that I had basically gotten bored with my PhD work. And I didn't know where to go from that, because what do you do as a failed academic? Like, Lord knows, successful academics have a hard enough time finding themselves a career. Right. So, like, so as I failed one, I wasn't really sure where it was going to go. So this looked to be some ways like, hey, here's an out that, like, you can always try. And worst case, you can always go back to this other thing. So I tried that, and then, but weirdly enough, at the same time as doing that, I am I got to know and start talking to this other blogger at the time in Dublin, or somebody else who had a blog. And the Irish tech scene being relatively unevolved at the time meant that, like, of course, two people who have blogs should definitely meet each other. Because there was only like 25 of us or whatever, you know. So I met this guy called Owen McCabe for coffee, and he had his own, he was a freelance designer at the time. I had just taken a job at a consultancy that he had said was pretty good. And then we kind of kept in touch. And then I did like maybe a year's worth of, you know, classic consultancy, like discovery, product requirements, usability testing, all that sort of shit. Like, you know, wearing stripy suits and fancy ties and going and meeting people and begging for business and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
And after a year of that, Owen mailed me somewhat out of the blue one, and I said, hey, I'm thinking about starting my own consultancy. Would you be interested? And I was like, yes. Because again, I just kind of plateaued. So that went on to become Contrast, which I'm guessing was the next thing you're going to talk to me about if you are following my my LinkedIn profile here.
Yes. Well, so I guess I'm curious. I mean, the Contrast thing, was that because you guys felt like there was this need there, or you just were tired of what you were previously doing? Like, what was sort of the purpose for you guys to come together?
It was, and you know, from Owen's point of view, it was like, let's build the best design consultancy that can be built. I know we can do it. I want it to be really different, and I want it to really stand out, and that's why it was called Contrast. From my point of view, it was like, I believe it can be done. I definitely feel like I've plateaued where I currently am, and I'm quite inspired by the idea of like taking this sort of step up to being like, you know, this company that's like, that doesn't concern itself with being the best in Dublin or even the best in fucking Ireland, but actually just the best. And that was kind of what we were really, really, really into. And I think, you know, an inspiring piece at the time for us was like the 37 Signals had obviously launched Basecamp in 03 or 05, no, sorry, 05 maybe or something like that. And like, we've been following their journey, and they were doing this awesome shit consistently. And like, you know, part of you is kind of blown away by it all. But another part of you is like, I kind of want to try. I kind of want to see, how far away, how far off the mark are we? You know, where are we weak? Where are we strong? So we said, let's do it. So I think it was August of 2008, I think, we opened the doors and got going.
Was the intent to just do consulting stuff, or was doing some sort of product thing like a la Basecamp?
The product thing was always on the cards. It was very much like, it was like, we will do consulting. Like the three things, the three outputs we had was a blog, a side product, and consulting. And consulting was there to make us enough money so that we could run a blog and spit out side products.
So how long did you guys have to do consulting before you guys got to work on your first product?
I guess, let me think. I mean, we kind of had it from the start. We had like bits and pieces. We launched, I think, maybe 8 months after we were, 8 months after we started the consultancy, I think we launched the product.
And did you guys, I say, like, yeah, there's multiple products. I mean, of Exceptional, was there anything else?
We launched a load of other products that either didn't work out or we sold. We launched a thing called Quitter, which was a tool for letting you know if someone quit following you on Twitter, which we sold. We built a product called Task 5. Task 5 was actually, I genuinely mean this, way ahead of its time. Task 5 was like a planner that lets you identify 5 and only 5 things that were the most important things you could do on any given day. And it was a team-based tool. So like, you'd add your whole team. So it'd be like me, Josh, whoever, would all be like, you know, different rows. And then the columns were like Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. It looked a lot like Trello or like To-Do, but neither of those tools existed for many years since. And you could drag and drop tasks in between people, and like, you know, your tasks could like move from one day to the other and stuff. And if a day passed and you hadn't completed everything, it would automatically push everything forward. And there was all sorts of very, very cool features in it. And I really like, I hate flattering myself by saying this, but it's probably one of the more ahead of our time things that we ever worked on. And that one just failed. You know, and like it failed, but it was one of those ones where you're looking at it going, there's definitely something here. Like, do you ever like have an idea that you didn't quite execute on, and you're looking, you're like, I'm going to see this thing again with someone else's name on it, and it's going to fucking succeed.
And then like, myself.
Yeah, well, you get over the hatred as long as you find something else. If you find your bare metrics or whatever, I'm sure you can let the other ones go. But like, but for sure, like there was like a kind of a funny wistful moment when I see things like say Trello getting acquired for $400 million, and like, you know, I mean Trello is a fantastic piece of software, and it had a lot of stuff that we never would have touched. But at the core, there was a shared idea there, like that that I think, you know, to some degree, I still think the task five thing. And by the way, I've seen literal implementations of the idea that we had since, so it's not like it's still there. But I think the core idea of like a very simple way for teams to share tasks, pass them back and forth, and minimize the number and all that. I think there's some genuinely good ideas there that like that don't necessarily need to get blown up the way, say, the likes of an Asana tool might.
Right, right. So task five, quitter, and then exceptional, and maybe a bunch of other things.
Like, there was a few others. Yeah, I can't remember. Like Twessipy, which is it? Yeah. Anyway, it doesn't really matter.
Oh man, I'm tempted to ask you to repeat that.
I said Twessipy. Twessipy was a Twitter bot, again ahead of its time. A Twitter bot that you would tweet, and you would tweet it with three ingredients, and it would reply with a recipe over Twitter. So we called it Twessipy. So if you said like eggs, milk, banana, it'd reply with like, I don't know, some sort of recipe for like an omelet or something. I don't know.
Oh man, if only, you know, and it's some sort of alternate reality. That's like the biggest thing that's ever been created.
Totally, the future of bots back then.
Right. So exceptional. And then it's my understanding like Intercom ultimately came out of something you guys had sort of built for exceptional, right?
Yeah, that's totally true. So I can tell you that story very quickly if you want. Like,
yeah, go for it.
So exceptional was a Ruby on Rails error tracker. So if an exception happened in your code, you'd get notified what had happened, what line it was. You could get an SMS, a push. You could even get a tweet about it because it was social. And, you know, you could also see what users were affected and that sort of stuff. And then, like, as a team, you could comment, you could assign it to each other, et cetera, just sort of basic management features there. We were the first one, but very quickly a tool called Hoptoad. Later it was called, I can't remember what it's called afterwards. There was like a few others that followed us shortly afterwards. And Airbrake was the one that came after. We basically, Exceptional has this trait, and I'm sure you probably don't experience this too deeply. But some tools have this infrastructural-like quality, which is they have to live inside other people's products. And there's a kind of an iceberg-like nature to the complexity that you adopt when you build something that sits inside other people's products. Specifically, a very buggy, big app can like cause you all sorts of, like, you know, it's effectively like a DDoS on your exception handler, right? Or thousands of shitly built open source things that you install your solution for free can also produce the same amount of problems, right? So what all that adds up to is like, reliability and scalability issues, speed issues, uptime issues, which means that we have to apologize to our users a lot. And every time we wanted to apologize, we had to, go to the database, pull out a list of active users, and then import it into Campaign Monitor or MailChimp and send out this mail to say, we're sorry we were down again, and then deal with all the replies. And the replies would always be like, dude, I haven't used your product in years. Why are you mailing me? Or there would be things like, hey, I wasn't using it yesterday, and I really don't care if it's down or not. I only care if it's down or not when I try to use it. And when I try to use it, it's not there, I'll get over it. So you can stop with these emails. So we thought, like, shit, why is it so hard to talk to our users and have these relatively simple conversations? So one day we decided that, like, maybe instead of, like, pushing out all these emails, when people log in, we'll just have a little speech bubble that pops up and says, hey, we're sorry Exceptional was down yesterday. We fixed a few things. We've improved the database. Here's a blog post about it. Hope this helps. And we did that. And then over time, we're like, wouldn't it be cool if we could see who has received this message? And that became otherwise known as an active user list, which you can now see in Intercom today because it's people who've logged in to see the message. And then over time, we're like, well, you know, we don't need to send a message to see who's logged in because we already have this code. And then over time, it was like, well, why don't we let people reply? And once we let people reply, people were like, dude, I want this tool. What is this thing? And then obviously, what happens when you don't want to message everyone? You just want to message your paying customers. Well, now you've got like targeted marketing, right? Except we didn't call it that back then. We just thought it'd be cool to talk to your paid customers. And you can sort of see how, like, when you start pulling on this thread, the whole idea of like talking to your customers is really, really important. Why is it so hard today? Becomes very obvious. So the next obvious iterations were then things like, well, what happens if a user has not been online for ages? Wouldn't it be cool if they could send an email, if you could send an email to them? And it all kind of built out. So like at some point, Owen made the point to Kieran. Owen was like, I really think like this little bubble is at least the big is at least the big a problem as a, you know, to solve as exceptional, but potentially way bigger and way more valuable. So at that point, we ultimately sold Exceptional and went all in on this product. We very immediately ran into a new problem, which was that we were able to build and prototype and play with Intercom on the Exceptional user base, if you like, right? Sure. Now we had no user base. We just had this concept of a problem. So we very quickly needed to build a backend for what, you know, became Intercom, just so that we could then start seeing it in action again. And then obviously we had to get our customers and, you know, kick on from there. This is like, in terms of timelines, we're at about 2010, 2011 now.
So what, I mean, how long were you guys working on Exceptional and then also on the product that would eventually become Intercom? I mean, like, yeah. I assume there's this time frame where you guys are all, or you're more excited about working on the little, what would become Intercom thing than you were Exceptional itself.
Yeah. I don't know how long the overlap period was. I would say maybe 6 months, maybe a little bit more. It was like, the sad reality is neither me nor Owen, and to a lesser degree, Kieran or David, who are the other two founders, none of us were really particularly excited about tracking exceptions for customers. It just wasn't honestly that interesting a thing. And like, I think like there's a genuine lesson there for other founders, which is that if your heart's not in it, you're really not going to be able to kill it, you know?
Sure. Sure. I still think it's like, you know, there's a lot of talk about working on solving problems that you're passionate about, but I think so many times you don't even find that you're really passionate about something until you've done something that you realize you're not passionate about.
I would agree. You know? Yeah. I think it's also sometimes people mistake what, you know, being passionate about building a business with being passionate about a domain. Like, as in they fall in love with the idea of having a startup and isn't it cool that we now have a user base and I love using Intercom and I love mailing my customers and all that. But then if you ask them, like, are you really into like solving the length of time it takes to get a dental appointment booked? And they're like, no, I don't care about that. And I'm like, okay, well, I think like your limit or I think at some point passion forms an upper ceiling for how successful you're ever really going to be. But like, you know, but you can still do very well within that ceiling, like as in you could still have a multi-million dollar business within that. I just think, you know, it's definitely the case that that when we switched to caring about like helping people grow their user base and making internet business personal and all sort of stuff, it definitely, I think we all felt that we had all this whole extra chamber of energy that Exceptional couldn't unlock for some reason.
Yeah. Sort of jumping off of that, I'd like to talk a bit about bundling and sort of unbundling software. So something that I found to be the case is we have built out Baremetrics and sort of expanded what problems we're solving. Is that customers really value being able to solve a number of problems in a single place. And I know I personally, I have like a solid case of tool fatigue. So you guys have multiple products at this point, that traditionally have been treated as separate products from other companies. So like, what's your take on bundling and unbundling software and the value of that and like where things are headed?
Yeah. I mean, it's a big meaty issue. So in no particular order, I think businesses generally hate trying to move data around because it usually sucks and you usually lose a lot of information. So as a result, people generally tend to prefer tools that where they don't have to move the data from A to B to C to D. It's just all in one place. I think that's kind of one big attraction. Now, a lot of people honestly misinterpret that and they think like, that all data should be in one place and they go off and they build some sort of SAP competitor and it doesn't work because it's just way too abstract. The consumer version of that, by the way, is like, all your files in one place. Isn't it weird that you have an Instagram account and a Flickr account? Put them all together. And like, it turns out that's actually not a problem. Like, you know, for businesses, however, the reason it's a problem, it's actually not a problem that Flickr and Instagram are in different places, because your workflows, and like Flickr is a shit example because it's so out of date, but I say Instagram and I don't know, like Snapchat or something like that, or Facebook photos or whatever. The reason that's not a problem is because people are usually doing different jobs in those tools. However, with businesses, you're actually, if you want to support a customer, you do actually want to know, are they paying or not? And if, and like that actually really, really enhances the support flow if you can make that distinction. But the reason most tools can't do that is because you can't connect your Stripe instance to your Zendesk instance or whatever, right? So like that's, you know, businesses really value when when data is, and workflows are combined in a way that's kind of multiplicatively valuable. So like, so doing something that's enhanced by other information is a good thing. But like, you know, taking two random businesses and trying to stick them together is not like, so being like, hey, we're also your Spotify and your Barometrics is not useful, you know? Sure. So like that's the first, that's the sort of the high level case, like for bundling, right? Like, is that you have these conjoined workflows and you have all these sharp edges in the normal world. And like, and the great big promise of like Web 2.0 was that somehow through APIs, all this shit would work together. But in practice, no one ever builds all that because you'd end up having full-time, you know, API engineers trying to daisy chain all your tools together. So when we released Intercom, this is one of the big pains that we would push forward, which is like, Wouldn't you like to be able to, like, you know, have all the data about what your customers are doing before you try and market to them? Wouldn't you like to know who you're supporting? Wouldn't you like to ask questions of specific types of users instead of everyone? And that really, really resonated. And that diagram that's on our homepage that has been ripped off so many million times, that like idea at its core, I think makes sense. So that's kind of like, you know, that's the emergence of bundling, if you like. And then in general, the, you know, there's a few other bits and pieces going on. One is like, when you have something like, there was an unbundling movement for a while. Like, so Facebook split up into Facebook and into like, say, Messenger and into like other point solutions, which most of which have died away except for Messenger. And there's a few other tools, like Foursquare had that famous split into Swarm and Foursquare. And there's been a few other cases of like kind of mass aware unbundling. For the most part, they've either been a no-brainer or they've been a very bad idea. The no-brainer, something like Facebook Messenger, can't really compete with the WhatsApps and Snapchats and WeChats and all that of the world as a separate app living on a tab in Facebook. So having its own sort of place makes sense, as long as you can make the integrations correctly. So I think, like, in general, unbundling was actually overrated as a thing. It only really makes sense when you happen to have created a tool that has multiple disjoint workflows on the same platform. And by disjoint, I mean they really have nothing to do with each other. And for some reason, combining them is causing you a big problem. And the only reason combining really causes you a big problem, assuming like it's not an architectural issue, is that on mobile, you have very limited real estate. So to actually sacrifice so much screen to this other half of the thing that most people aren't using is a waste of time. So that's why you would split it up. In general, business tools tend toward bundling.
And I totally agree with that. I mean, I think what we've seen newer businesses do is take the advice to say that you should get really good at solving one thing, and then they build this hyper specific tool that sure, like, it solves the problem really well, but at the expense of, you know, being another thing somebody's got to sign up for.
And that's like the silent cost. Now, that's such a good point. And I think I heard you speak about this recently or blog about this recently, but that's such a silent cost that no one ever does, which is the actual overhead of just being another tool in the chain is actually quite significant. So I could tell you, like, you can have the very best, you know, Dunning email sender, but if you already have Barometrics, you're like, you know what? If these guys can do it, just stick it on here, because I don't want yet another fucking thing to log into and tweak and configure and have another account and all that sort of stuff and another bill and another invoice. So I think, like, that's genuinely a thing that, you know, it's the, and like the conclusion of that, which people can occasionally get depressed by, is something like, it means that, like, the proliferation of tools versus the consolidation of tools is in some sense going to be a trade-off of specificity for solution versus a simple work life where you only have like 5 or 10 key apps to use versus the 50 or 60 that most people use today, which means that basically like it's definitely true that the best product won't always win. And you can even like the consumer example of this is maybe like the Instagram stories versus Snapchat. Like it's getting harder and harder to see why Instagram stories isn't good enough for your average person and why they still need Snapchat, you know?
Yep. So why do you think that Intercom has been able to sort of stand out in all these different markets? I mean, is that because of the bundling that you guys, you know, you've got the live chat stuff, you've got sort of help desk stuff. I mean, like, why have you guys been able to sort of buck the trend in that sense?
So what's the trend you're referring to? Just when you say,
I mean, I'm just saying, I'm saying like, you know, you think of like, you've got, it's sort of the specific tool thing, but I mean, the fact that a lot of those were really specific things that were big and you guys just kind of came in and said, nah, we're just gonna do it all. And then like, you've done it really well and succeeded in that.
Yeah. I think the innovation within Intercom has been like, mostly around making them all work together. And the key insight being that like, that the data that each thing brings to the next is really valuable and people aren't getting it any other way. So like, you know, having a singular view of your customer where you can, you know, talk to them on your website, convince them to start a trial, send them, you know, send them their email, support them all the way through their product, you know, all that, and then market to them if they're not using certain features, and then like announce your next launch and put them on your newsletter. Being able to do all that from one place is actually surprisingly valuable and surprisingly useful. But I don't, you know, that's my core answer. The other thing I'd say is like that, you know, in a lot of cases we were just a better product. And I don't, like, that sounds self-serving, but like, you know, if you consider the world pre-Intercom, what it looked like to talk to a business, there wasn't, you know, the idea of having a full-on, like, you know, consumer-grade messenger experience on a site so you could talk directly to a founder, see who they are, see where they're from, you know, exchange photos, files, screenshots, all that. It just wasn't common. It just, like, it wasn't there. It is now there. And so, I think we genuinely did raise the standard of what it meant to talk to a business online. And for that, we definitely got a lot of attention and a lot of traction.
Yeah, yeah. So content has played a big role for you guys. Like, you prolifically publish content on your blog. You've published a number of books. You're on the second like world tour, which is essentially like a live event version of all the stuff that you guys have published.
Yeah.
So like producing all of that is this incredible undertaking. How did you guys come to use all of those things as this significant marketing channel for you guys?
It started actually back in Contrast, really. Like, we always felt like, you know, that if we could communicate good ideas and fresh thinking to the world would respect us. And then when it came to like, hey, we need someone to design our product, that they might hire Contrast. The second version of that was like, you know, in August 2011, we were like, hey, we need people to install Intercom so that we have some customers. How can we do that? And I was like, well, we're going to write ideas that target users will want to hear. So like, we wrote ideas for startups. Here's how you grow users. Here's how you think about naming. Here's how you get people to use a feature. Here's how you think about retention and churn. I think I wrote like 93 of the first 100 blog posts on the Intercom blog, and it was all just what fresh thinking or sharp ideas do we have that startups will read and it will resonate. And then every now and then when we're finishing a piece about how to re-engage a user, we can be like, PS, this is something Intercom does. And that basically worked is the most honest answer I can give you. It's like, it, you know, people connected with the ideas, people regard the blog highly, people, you know, they, you know, read it in the hundreds of thousands, frequently. And I think the strategy was like, you know, it's very different to the classic content marketing strategy, but it was very much like, we're only going to write stuff that we think is really useful. And when we have a really useful idea, we will write it and we'll treat it with the same priority that we treat anything else. So like, you know, people often say some version of, I mean, especially when I'm doing media interviews, it's always like, where do you get the time to write the book, to write the blog, to write the, and I say like, it's the same place that the engineers get time to write the source code. You know,
right.
It's just fucking important. You know, so like for us, it was very genuinely part of my job for quite a while was make sure that people are hearing about Intercom and talking about Intercom. And even if they don't know what it is yet, because we didn't even know what it was yet. We were calling it like a CRM, a messaging tool at the time or something. But like, it was just like, make sure that at the very least, when people see that smiley face and that icon, that this is not for the first time. And, you know, we had a few posts spike very high on Hacker News. We had like, you know, Daring Fireball link us up in the early days and stuff. And that kind of got us our kind of seed traffic where it was like, okay, this thing's for real now. People are reading everything we write. And then the books kind of fell out of that naturally. The events came out of that naturally as well, the podcast too. And now it's like a team of four, soon to be five, who are responsible for producing all of the content. And they also work with our events team who kind of make sure it all happens live as well. But like, yeah, it's a full-on chunk of our marketing, and we respect it as such. And I think when people get content marketing wrong, it's because they treat it as this, oh, we need to get the blog going quick, hire some fucking content marketers to spit out some bullshit pieces. And like, that's just such a brand destructive thing to do. Always treated it with a good degree of respect. And I think it's a long-term versus short-term thing, but it does work.
Well, that's what I was going to say, like the long-term play, can't be understated. I mean, like it takes years. I mean, really for it to really become this thing. Like you might have a couple of, you know, you mentioned like Daring Fireball and others, like link it up and you get these little spikes, but I mean, it is a really long play. And I think most people end up getting burnt out on it because they put all this effort into two or three, they don't really get anything from it. And then they're like, it didn't work.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's so true. And but like most people don't even have the patience to last a year, let alone two or three before they give up. But people are looking for a smash hit, and it's always the same story. It's like, hey Des, how do we get a blog like Intercom's? And I say, oh well, you know, you research the sort of areas you're selling into really well, write stuff they want to read, come up with inspiring pieces, blah blah. And they're like, okay, well if we can't do all that, what do we do? And I'm like, I don't know. And then like 2 weeks later, I get a mail saying, hey, so we hired a content marketer and he wrote this piece. Can you link it up on Twitter, please? And I'm just like, that's not how it works. You know, I'm sorry, but that's not how it works.
I think our best posts have been the ones where like I've in my head committed to publishing something basically every Wednesday. And then like Tuesday, I mean, you know, less than 24 hours before, I'm like, I got to shove something out. And then I just, you know, start writing.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's you know, the idea, like, it's not, you know, there are different models for how, like, volume games work. Like, so say, like, Hollywood spits out, like, hundreds of films, but there's a few smash hits every year, and that's one model. If you take, like, say, writers, like, you know, if you write one great novel, you're down as, like, you'll be remembered as a famous novelist, even if every other novel you wrote was absolute dog shit, because you people remember your peak there. People remember your averages in some business. Like, you know, if you're like a mediocre soccer player who had one great season, you're basically a mediocre soccer player. For whatever it is, people think that blogging is like, you know, every piece has to smash up the scoreboard and blow the world away. That's actually not true. But I think what happens is you will see people eye roll and unsubscribe and unfollow if you publish junk. And it's a net negative thing to do. Like, it's, you know, a bad piece does more damage than no piece. I think that's something people get wrong. But at the same time, a good piece is worth publishing always, even, you know, you only need a few greats here and there. But I think the piece people get most wrong is like setting a specific quota, like 10 posts a week or whatever, because they heard that, you know, some other company did that. Sure. And then seven of those are shit. And then the whole blog goes to nothing very quickly. And it's very, like, it's very much a reputation game. Like, you have a good blog and you yourself have a good brand and a good name because you've been spitting out quality, thoughtful stuff around SaaS for like 2-3 years. Yeah. And like, you know, if you start sharing shit, you're done. Like, you know, no one will say it to you, but they're all going to quietly unfollow you. That's just how it works.
Yep. Was there any singular inflection point for you guys where growth just, I mean, significantly changed?
Not to the degree that it was like champagne bottles and stuff, but there's been moments where there's been like, so famously we wrote about and blogged about like when we released a CSV importer for Intercom, which was an alternative to sign up instead of JavaScript. That was just genuinely like, you know, it was, you know, I guess like our funnel had like, you know, had improved by 40% in throughput, not like as in 40% over where it was before. And that just really meant that things accelerated. And that was like, that was one big step. I think the other one was like when we were in beta pricing for 1 year where we were just charging $50 flat fee no matter who you were. Once we actually came off that and we're like, all right, let's start charging like, you know, bronze, silver, gold, like 50, 150, 450 or something like that. That was when like when I felt like that first time that I felt like real revenue was coming into the business. And there are the moments where you're like, oh, this is going to be bigger than I thought. But there's definitely been no one marketing tactic where we've turned a corner. Kind of connected to the previous point, like blogging isn't the thing where one day everything clicks and you get like this, you turn this corner. It's like a slow, slow ramp that will get you there eventually, but that you won't see any big massive uptick at any because of one blog post.
Yep. What's been the hardest thing for you guys about building Intercom?
Definitely there's some engineering wise, there's some very big challenges. Like we have like very, very big customers using us for very, very big and important use cases. And that involves sending like, I think like 400 million conversations are held through our platform. I think we've over a billion user records. We've all sorts of like genuine challenges like that. We try to support 17,000 customers. So like there's lots of like challenges that are just natural to scale. I think we've struggled, or I've struggled with like with the things that we can't do that I also know are happen to be brilliant ideas. Like there's a lot of tools that like even in 3 minutes at a whiteboard, you could probably come up with 2 to 3, $5 to $10 million ARR businesses that are missing from the Intercom platform, and you know we know about them all and we're not doing them, and that can be frustrating at times, you know. Like that's the whole saying no thing and just focusing on the pieces that matter most. But I genuinely the piece, like we have like a lot of like frankly like, you know, copycats or ripoffs or whatever. Sure. And I think they all hit a wall at some point because actually it's a fucking hard product to build. And people are, you know, you always get these questions like, what's the secret, or how did you manage to get to the process problem? You're like, how do you manage to get past it? We're 6 years old. We've been at this for a long time. We've 350 people trying to work on this. You know, it's not actually like, oh, there's one top tip, or like, oh, you didn't find that PHP library. We did. You know, it's not, it's like, it's just a fucking hard problem. I'm sorry. You know, so like, I think, you know, it's definitely like there's no shortage of challenging tasks you'll meet along the way for sure.
You mentioned the, you know, sitting there with the whiteboard for a little bit, you could come up with a $5-10 million business that you could add to Intercom. Is the reason to not add those because of trying to keep the scope, like basically preventing scope creep, or is it because of those engineering and scaling challenges of like making that new product work across tens of thousands of customers?
It's bandwidth. It's, you know, it's like, as in we're very stable right now. Our reliability is like rock solid. We had a really, really good quarter, like 5.9s in most areas. From a scope creep point of view, I think our most recent like refresh and redesign has kind of neatly separated the products into their own sort of contained areas, which kind of, you know, paves the way for us if we were to ever add more products. But right now, like, you know, one way to put it is like marketing automation is a multi-billion-dollar business. Customer support is a multi-billion-dollar business. How many of these do you want? You know. Right. But like, you know, if we take like any example of something we could easily layer on, it itself like would be a whole another group of, it'd be like, we'd need to hire like at least 10, 15, 20 more people to run it. It would like, you know, it would need to be a whole new, all that's just to build it. Then you have all the fallout. You have to have a whole marketing team. You have to increase your customer support team proportionally. You need to start reporting on it as a line of business. You need to have sales reps working on it. You know, it's like genuinely bandwidth and like, you know, like let's nail the areas we're in and then we can work on the next one is kind of what the thinking is. But at the same time, it definitely frustrates me whenever I have to use a tool outside of the Intercom domain because I'm like, damn it, this should be on Intercom, you know?
Sure.
I'm sure you've
Was there a time that you? Yeah, for sure. Was there a time that you guys thought that Intercom wasn't going to make it?
No. Right up until we launched it, it was like a big, you know, will they, won't they sort of thing. We had no users or whatever. We launched it with some users, but like, I think once it got going, it never really stopped. But there was definitely like, I mean, like the pessimism and doubt and like, you know, you can't really afford yourself too much time to think like that in the early days. You really need to be somewhat deluded to give it a try. So I'd say, like, I don't know, I'd say for the first 6-9 months, it was kind of anyone's guess if this thing will work. But as I said, once we launched it and people started using it and people started seeing it, like, you know, it's just, it's caught on like wildfire. It hasn't really looked back.
Yeah. What's the next year look like for you guys? Like, what stuff, not necessarily product stuff in the pipeline, but like, what's a big focus for you guys?
For me, genuinely, I mean, we still have to do the North American part of the world tour. We obviously will have, you know, more content related projects to work on. There's obviously some big product stuff coming this year as well, which we're probably not going to talk about for a while. Yeah. We're now 3 offices. We'll probably have to open 1 or 2 more offices, to cover time zones and or to attract talent. So I think there's like a lot of the boring company hygiene stuff, will, you know, is definitely going to, you know, sit there for a while the product team will continue to sort of kick ass in the way they do. But yeah, aside from that, like, me personally, my role, I run marketing at the moment. So, you know, a lot of what I'm thinking about is all the marketing related projects, which is, you know, you'll see some of this stuff drip out, but like the biggest area of focus right now is making sure that we do a kick-ass American World Tour, or American, Australia and Canada. And then, yeah, I don't actually know exactly what we're planning on the content side of things, but I know we're trying different things that maybe it won't be. We just did our first printed book and we might actually do more printed books. But I also know we're going to come back and maybe look at a different content formats yet again.
Cool. That sounds awesome. Well, Des, that is all that I have got, sir. Thanks for hopping on a call.
No problem, Josh. And I wish you all the best with Baremetrics. Congrats on the 1 million, by the way.
All right. Appreciate it, man.
Thank you.
There we have it, Des Trainer of Intercom. Thanks for listening this week. If you need revenue analytics and insights, check out baremetrics.com. If you have any feedback, I'd love to hear it. Shoot me an email, josh@baremetrics.com, or on Twitter @Spigvard. Head to founderchats.com to listen to a heaping pile of other conversations with startup founders. If you enjoyed this, a rating on iTunes means a heck of a lot. And that's it. Thanks for listening. See you next week.